Hello and welcome to On Not Knowing, a series of conversations about cultivating a growth mindset. Today's guest is science writer and head of communications at IBM Research Europe, Katja Moskovich. Welcome to the program, Katja.
Thank you very much.
So Katja, I know you grew up in Russia, so tell us a little about that.
Sure, I was born in Russia, but we moved to Seattle when I was 11. I don't remember much from my Russian-Soviet childhood. I was born in 1980, so up until the time we moved to the US, I was living in mainly Soviet country, right, at the time. It was very different. I just remember it was very cold in the winter, and we didn't have a lot of stuff. And I remember my dad went to Poland for the first time ever when they opened the borders and brought us some jeans and a skateboard for me. And that was a lot of fun. And nobody had skateboards in my school. So that was something. And then we moved. And yeah, we lived in Seattle and then we moved to Canada.
Did you live in Moscow or where did you live?
I was born in Siberia, but I lived in Siberia for the first 3 or 4 years. And then we moved to the Caucasus region and near the Black Sea. Again, really only for a few years, and I don't remember much. But then we moved to Moscow when I was about 8. So I went to second grade or something like that in Moscow. I remember Moscow a bit better.
I see. But so what is there a story behind why you were born in Siberia?
At the end of 19th century, my great-grandmother, I think it must be, moved to Siberia from Ukraine. It was a difficult journey and they moved on horses and they founded a village. It was actually quite a lot of people that were moving at the time to Siberia because of famine in Ukraine and they wanted to start a new life and find fertile lands. So they moved and I remember going to that village as a kid. It was fun. It was a lot of fun. But then they moved to the big city, to the capital of Siberia, so to speak, if you can call it a capital. And that's where I was born.
So it's not as cold and remote as Westerners tend to think of Siberia?
It is pretty cold and remote. It's very industrialized, though. Novosibirsk is a big city. So if you don't spend your entire life in the village, like my great-grandmother did, then in the city. It's basically very similar to any other big city.
Okay. And so then the Iron Curtain, when did that come down in 89, was it? Or?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah. I vaguely remember the collapse of the Soviet Union and the perestroika and the putsch. My mom took me and my brother to the barricades in Moscow after lots of people went on the streets. And I think 3 people died at the time during the putsch. And we went to Seattle first to learn English for a year, but we didn't stay. We came back to Moscow, and then my parents immigrated to Montreal in Canada.
Not a common destination for Soviets to go to immediately to Seattle. Did you like it there?
I remember the fish market where they throw fish in the air. That's a big thing. Uh-huh. So that's pretty much the only thing I remember. Oh, I remember my school, my middle school. So that was fun. I didn't know any English at the time. So it was a steep learning curve.
Uh-huh. And did you just fly there from Moscow?
We did. Yeah, well, we did. Yes, from Moscow. We flew via Alaska, I think, if I remember correctly, via Anchorage. So it was a long flight.
Oh, wow. Uh-huh. But exciting for a young person. So you went with your whole family?
We did, yes. But then my dad had to come back to Moscow. So we stayed with my mom for that year just to learn the language. And then we went back. And I don't remember exactly what year that was, but that's about when the Chechen War started. And so my parents were a bit worried because I have a younger brother and they were against the war, but also they were worried that he would be drafted at some point, even though he was a kid at the time. So that was also one of the reasons why they really wanted to move and they decided to go to Canada.
So you were 11 at the time, is that right? And how old was your brother?
So he's 2 years younger than me.
And so that was your family of 4. And what kind of, you know, what kind of careers did your father and mother have?
My dad is he doesn't work anymore now much, but he's a journalist and a writer. He writes children's books, but he used to be a radio journalist at Russian section of CBC. And my mom is a doctor. She's a pediatrician.
Oh, wow. So how have your parents influenced you?
Well, I wanted to be a journalist ever since I can remember, really. I remember I created my first newspaper in Russia when I must have been 7, first or second grade. And I printed it. My dad, he had a fax machine. So we created a few copies using the fax machine, not even a photocopying machine. And I remember writing some text and taking pictures from magazines, cutting them out, using scotch tape to put them on there and making copies. It was called The Planet. It was fun. My parents probably still have a copy.
Oh, nice. And you distributed this to your relatives? Or...
No, that was for school. That was for my class. Okay. Yeah, for my classmates.
And you ended up getting a degree in astrophysics. So how did you cultivate an interest in science?
Well, astrophysics came way, way later, actually. I got it when I was already in my 30s, so when I was an adult. I was always interested in science and in space specifically, and I wanted to be an astronaut. So my first degree is in engineering, mechanical engineering. And I went to study engineering, not because I like engineering. I actually don't really like it much at all. Well, I have nothing against it, but I wouldn't see myself as an engineer. But in my Montreal high school at the time, there was a portrait of Canadian female astronaut Julie Payette, who then went on to become the governor general later. So I got so inspired. I must have been 15 or 16 that I wrote her a letter asking what would she recommend. And I knew that she studied engineering at McGill University in Montreal. She responded. I never expected her to respond, but she responded sending a postcard back of a Canada arm on the ISS and a little Christmas tree kind of superimposed on it. It was a Christmas postcard, so it was super cute. And she said, you just have to go into science or engineering and you'll get there. So that's why I went into engineering, but I also wanted to be an astronaut and I wanted to combine engineering and possibly be a jet pilot, but that didn't happen because when I went to the Canadian Flying Academy, they said that my vision wasn't 100%. So if you don't have 100% vision, or at least at the time, you couldn't be a jet pilot. So I thought, okay, well, I can't be a pilot. I don't really want to be an engineer, but I hope I can still be an astronaut, even though I understood by then that that's probably unlikely.
Why? You can apply. I actually know someone who went quite far through the process of trying to become an astronaut. Did you apply?
No, I didn't. I got a little bit discouraged and I thought, okay, well, what am I going to do? Am I going to stay in this faculty, continue this degree, even though I don't like it so much? So I went and visited a journalism school in Ottawa when I was, I think, in my second year. And that was the best.
Where were you as an undergrad?
At McGill. So I ended up going to the same university Julie Payette went to mechanical engineering. And I was ready to drop out and move to journalism school. But the director of that, of the journalism school in Ottawa, then gave me, we literally spoke for maybe 10, 15 minutes max. And he gave me the best career advice I think I've ever had from anybody, including all the high school career advisors. He said, journalism, especially print journalism, is a dying career. He was a little bit discouraging. He said, you know, so many people want to be journalists. And especially if you just do journalism as an undergraduate degree, you'll end up with a lot of competition. So why don't you just finish your engineering degree and then do journalism as a master's? And that hadn't occurred to me at the time. So I thought, okay, that actually makes sense because I was already in my second year, just a couple more years to finish. And then I did go on to get my MA from Western Ontario, and that helped me immensely to get into science and technology journalism with that engineering background.
I see. So your MA was in journalism. So you have a bachelor's in engineering, mechanical engineering, and a master's of fine arts in journalism. Okay, and then you eventually went back for a MPhil in astrophysics.
Yeah, but that was like 10 or 12 years later. I noticed that I was writing more and more about space, even though when I was working at the BBC, one of my first jobs in the science section and then technology section for online, I was writing obviously on everything. You write about dinosaurs today, asteroids tomorrow. You don't get to pick and choose. It's whatever you need to write about. But I noticed that I didn't like writing about dinosaurs so much. I prefer, even though, again, nothing against dinosaurs specifically, but I preferred writing about space. And then I started writing feature stories, so not just short science news stories that are easy to write because you usually get a press release and you can just, you know, rephrase it a little bit and you're all set. But if you want to write a feature story, then you really have to understand what you're writing about. And the more I was writing that, the more it occurred to me how difficult the subject matter was. And I wasn't understanding half of it or 75% of it. I would talk to scientists, I would interview them, but then to explain it to others, I was nearly cheating myself because I knew that I wasn't really understanding it myself. And how can I then properly explain it to the audience? So that's when I went to King's College. I was working for Nature magazine at the time already. And I said, look, I'm at Nature. I'm writing all this great stuff, meaning great subject, great topics, right? But I really want to understand it better. Mm-hmm. So I would like to do a PhD in theoretical physics.
Okay, so let's back up a little bit, just chronologically to get the story. So you did your bachelor's in engineering at McGill. Then you went on for a master's of arts in journalism.
And then I went to Moscow for a year to work as a reporter at AP, Associated Press. Okay. That was my first job. And that was fun, but that was not science. It was more political reporting, covering... There was a bomb in the market, or whatever was happening, you just cover whatever happens around you. And I didn't enjoy it so much. But then I moved to Paris and I started working for France 24, again, as a political reporter.
Well, I'm not familiar with that. Is it a magazine?
No, that's a broadcaster. It's like a national French broadcast, international rather. So they broadcast in English, French, and I think Arabic as well. I worked there for a while before we moved to London. We lived in Paris for 5 years, I think. And then when I moved to London, that's when I started working for the BBC. First in the Russian service for a year, but then I moved to the science section and then to technology section. So I stayed there for a few years.
How long were you at the BBC?
So I was in London in total of 12 years. So at the BBC, I must have been... four or five.
Ah, okay. And now you're in Zurich, isn't that right?
That's correct, yeah.
In Zurich, okay. And so what led you to Zurich and to IBM?
So after BBC, I decided to go freelance for about a year or so. And that's when I decided to go deeply into science journalism. And so I started working freelancing for A New Scientist, various other magazines like the Science section of The Economist, some US outlets too, Scientific American a little bit.
These are big deal publications. Wow. You're really stepping up your game to the elite science, popular science magazines.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I guess once you decide to specialize, that's what you end up writing for. And it's very rewarding as well because you work with brilliant people and you end up producing really good quality journalism. So That was my goal. But this is also around the time when I decided to get a PhD. That was the idea in astrophysics.
So where did you go for that?
King's College.
King's College, in London, I guess.
Yeah, exactly, in London.
And so tell us about that. Did you stop everything or did you do that while you were working? Or
I was working at a technology magazine in London at the time. It's called ENT, Engineering and Technology. And I was working there full-time as a technology editor, and I asked my boss if I could also specialize in astrophysics or theoretical physics, and he said, yes, that's a great idea. So I was trying to do my PhD at the time. I was also pregnant at the time, and that was a little bit difficult to combine a full-time job, being pregnant, and studying for a PhD. So I took a year off and my younger kid was born. So I went back and I had a conversation with them because I didn't know if I really wanted to finish the PhD. And that's when they recommended that I do half of a PhD, which is an MPhil. I don't know if it exists in the US, but it's basically in the UK, it's quite a popular degree, Master of Philosophy. You still defend a thesis, you still work on a specific topic, but it takes half the time. And as I was studying part-time, not full-time, for me, the full PhD would have been 7 years or so part-time, and MPhil took me about 4 years part-time.
And so during this time, is that when you got interested in neutron stars? I know you have a pretty well-known book about neutron stars.
Because I was writing a lot about all different aspects of astrophysics, there was a really interesting and important event that happened. It was a collision of two neutron stars, and they were the gravitational wave detectors, LIGO and Virgo, detected tiny ripples in space-time, gravitational waves. So that was a really big deal for astronomers, astrophysicists. I was covering that for Quantum magazine, so I wrote a big story. And then I received a LinkedIn message from a guy who claimed to be one of the editors at Harvard University Press. And he was very funny because he was just saying that he was reading my articles and what I wanted to write a book. And I didn't even pay attention because I thought, okay, it's LinkedIn, probably some marketing thing. And turns out that he was really actually a genuine editor at Harvard University Press. And we're actually still in touch. He's a lovely guy, Jeff Dean. They gave me carte blanche. They said, you can write whatever it is, you know, that inspires you. And because I was covering that collision of two neutron stars at the time, I thought that would be a good subject for a book, effectively. And, you know, I looked around and there were not too many books on neutron stars at all. A lot on black holes, but not much on neutron stars.
Okay, so I think that one thing you have to do is, since black holes are all the rage in the popular press, everybody sort of knows about a black hole. Tell us a little bit about the neutron stars. And you call them the zombies of the universe. So why? What are neutron stars, and why do you describe them as the zombies of the universe?
Yeah, they're actually really, really cool. In my opinion, they are way cooler than black holes because, well, black holes, as you said, everybody knows about them, right? Like little kids know about them and they seem fascinating, but black holes are just radiation. But neutron stars are the densest forms of matter that we know of. So they are very, very small. They form when a giant star dies, like not a star the size of the sun, but bigger than the sun.
Doesn't a neutron star get created as a result of a supernova explosion?
Exactly. That's exactly that. A huge, massive star dies in a supernova explosion. And then what's left behind is this tiny, tiny object, about 20 kilometers in diameter. And it's impossible to detect it optically. You can only detect it with radio telescopes because it's producing radio waves from both magnetic poles. And we can detect it with our radio telescopes. And they're so dense that if you, for example, were to take like a teaspoon of that neutron star matter, that would weigh billions of tons. So these are neutron stars and we don't know much about them, but they are fascinating.
So. Yeah, but we know some, I think they have very strong magnetic moments, right? And they spin around real fast.
That's true. Yes, they do spin around. Some are slower than others. They are those that spin about 600 revolutions a second. We've been detecting them since, I think, 1967. And yes, they are the most magnetic objects in the universe that we know of. But we don't know what's inside, for example. We know that the last thing that remains after a star dies is iron, because different elements get fused together, produce energy. And so that's why a typical star shines, produces heat during its lifetime. The heavier and heavier elements will be fusing and fusing together to continue this reaction. And finally, we get to iron, and that's the last stop because nothing can get fused anymore. And so that's the moment when the big star would explode in a supernova explosion. And that's why we know that iron gets left behind. So the outer shell of the neutron star is made of iron. We know that much. But if you were to drill down, for example, towards the core, then really weird things would happen. We think that at first it's neutrons, of course. That's why it's called a neutron star. So neutrons are the particles inside of an atom. You've got protons and neutrons, right? But then because the pressures are so huge, as you keep going towards the center, we actually don't know if the neutrons are still intact, or maybe the neutrons get squashed and you get to something called, we call it quark jelly. That would be super exotic, because on Earth, we only get quarks as triplets inside neutrons and protons. But inside a neutron star, we are guessing that maybe they actually float around freely. Like, that would be super cool to discover.
But there's probably no path to actually discovering anything about the center of a neutron star.
Well, we've got a number of ways to probe them. You know, indeed, we cannot fly there and, you know, do it observationally. That would be impossible.
Sadly. Okay, so in 1967, when you had these two neutron stars colliding, you know, they each have incredibly strong gravitational force. What prevented them from colliding and merging together and perhaps even forming a black hole at that point?
Right. That was in 2017 when they collided.
Oh, 2017, I think. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. 1967, that's when we discovered the first first pulsar neutron star that we can register radio waves from. We call them pulsars. So that's when we found one. But when they collide, indeed, you're absolutely right. If they are sufficiently massive, they would actually collapse into a black hole. We think that those two that collided, because there was no object left behind, we think that they indeed collapsed into a black hole straight away. Because as long as you add a little bit of matter to an already massive neutron star, it will collapse into a black hole. It will not stay a neutron star anymore.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay, so very, very interesting story about the book and or the your voyage into neutron stars and ultimately writing this book. So I have a growth-minded themed question that I ask all guests. And the question for you is the following. Was there some event in your life that you initially experienced as a failure or setback, but which subsequently became the launching point for a new and interesting direction in which you took your life or career?
I would say that it's the fact that I started studying mechanical engineering and realized halfway through that this is really not something I want to do. And if I ever design an airplane, I don't suggest anybody flies in that airplane. So I was to the point that I was really disappointed. But finishing that degree really helped me in my future career, science journalism. So
it seems like you've reoriented your career quite a few times. You've reinvented yourself. First transitioning from mechanical engineering to journalism, then taking the second degree, and then having a child and having to figure out what your priorities really were. So it's interesting.
So I think that really helped me in terms of understanding what I really wanted to do, and ultimately what also took me to IBM, because I had to change careers. And I remember working as a journalist. It was really super interesting all the time. You work on different stories, and it's very rewarding being, especially in science, being a science reporter, science feature writer, when you can actually dig deeper, understand something new, and when you already know the topic, so you're able to play with your own knowledge, and whoever you're interviewing, you understand what they are telling you, and then you can craft your narrative and write a really beautiful feature. I visited IBM Zurich Lab as a reporter in 2019, I think, and I wrote a story about quantum and also about CERN. I visited CERN in Geneva, and it was a feature on how CERN was using quantum computers. And that particular story, first of all, earned me an award, which was super cool, as like European Journalist of the Year award. And then they also offered me a job. So that's what brought me to Zurich. And my first job was actually all about storytelling. It was right before COVID. I was supposed to go from lab to lab, talk to researchers, write for IBM research blog, and just for stories from different labs. But then COVID happened, so that had to change. I went to a couple of labs in Johannesburg and in the UK, and that was it. So,
you know, I was once the chief scientist in Africa. So what was your experience like in Johannesburg? I'm curious. And did you write a story about that lab?
I did write a couple of things for the blog. It was great. It was a little bit tricky going outside because You know, they told me that I couldn't go outside by myself. I had to leave my phone behind and I had to have two people accompany me to the supermarket. Apart from that, the lab itself was, it was a great experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're doing quite a bit of quantum down there.
Yep, that's true.
Okay, yeah. So overall, what is your day-to-day life like as head of communications of IBM Research Europe? Is it anything like your prior experience as a science journalist for the big media companies?
Yes, of course. I'm still using the same knowledge and I'm thinking strategically. I'm working with journalists and I'm kind of crafting the story on the other side, right? So I try to offer journalists a story in a way how I would write it. And then, of course, they're all clever themselves, so they will change it the way they want to change it. But being able to offer them an interesting angle, an interesting take on a story is really rewarding, especially when, you know, when it gets published. So
I see. So you're basically playing the other side of these stories. You're helping the journalist craft an interesting story about IBM.
Exactly.
That's your day-to-day job, by and large.
Yeah, that's what we all do in communications. Exactly. Mm-hmm.
All right. Thanks a lot for chatting with us. That wraps up today's episode of On Not Knowing. You've definitely had a career that's continuously stepping out of the beaten track. And I appreciate just your candor with which you presented your story. It's been fascinating. Thanks also to our producer, Andy Aaron, my co-host, Heloisa Candelo, our lead production engineer, Cindy Zeal, and I'm John Lenschner. Thanks for listening.